Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Barry Levinson, who's written a novel, 66. Barry Levinson is better known for being a producer, director, writer in Hollywood, has written and directed some very, very fine films, including Diner, which was written and directed by Barry Levinson, Rain Man, which was just directed by you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good Morning Vietnam was also just directed, but the auteur movies, if you want to call them that, Liberty Heights, Avalon, more recently directed An Everlasting Peace, which we'll talk about during the program, Bandits, and a new movie coming out soon called Envy?
In the spring.
With
Ben Stiller, Jack Black, and Christopher Walken. Kind of an absurd, wild type of comedy.
Barry Levinson, 66, brings us back to Baltimore. I guess you're kind of the anti-John Waters. I assume you know John Waters.
Yes, I do. Yes.
And the two of you kind of look at Baltimore in the same era, but they're two very, very different takes.
Yeah, because we've talked about that, John and I, from different sort of points of view and different sides of the city.
66 takes place in the same milieu as Diner, only it takes place some 6 or 7 years later.
Right.
It also takes place in the same milieu as the movie Liberty Heights. It seems to take place in Liberty Heights, though it's not named specifically.
No, but it's the same diner in terms of storytelling.
Why a novel about the same theme? Why not another movie?
I'm not sure why it came out this way. It just did. It took that form, and I sort of went with it. And I've sort of relied on instinct for most of my career. So it sort of took that form, and I thought, oh, well, okay, this is where I'm going. I'll see what it is. How can I accomplish, that form?
What part of 66 is autobiographical?
This is the first time I tackled my generation specifically. Diner is really the generation, or half generation in front of me. I basically was, in a sense, the teenager at the beginning of rock and roll. And we were defined as that rock and roll generation. You know, we were it. And then all of a sudden, 66, I'm now 23, 22 years old, and all of a sudden, there's another generation, very different, you know, hippies, counterculture, big change, and you may be only separated by a couple years, and you feel much older, and all of a sudden, someone might, you know, see you because you're wearing a shirt and a tie and a jacket, and your hair is kind of combed back, a Brill Cream kind of look, and there's somebody with shaggy kind of hair and, you know, wearing jeans. And all of a sudden you feel older, and someone might say, you know, as I show in the book at one point, someone says, thanks, sir. And you're going, sir, I'm like 22 years old here. I mean, you know, it's like a stab to the heart. And I thought, well, can I explore that? Can I look at that phenomenon coming sort of a collision of generations in a sense and explore that? And do I take a lot of, you know, me into that? Yes. You know, the character Bobby Shines, very much like when I worked in local television, almost every incident in there actually did in fact happen. And then for characters, I will blend and make, you know, composites out of that. And a lot of the situations, again, were in fact, you know, real.
As a director, when you're doing that, is a part of you thinking casting so that you see an actor, let's say, in your mind's eye as you're writing a character?
No, I see people. I see people, that I knew, friends that I had. That's what I'm really looking at. I'm not thinking of it in that part of it, because that's closer to me.
When you're working on a novel, after having written so many screenplays and directed films, and the directing part includes working closely with the editor, has that become so instinctive that you automatically write like that, or is the process different?
Process of writing a novel is very different from the process of a screenplay. Screenplay, you have to be much more economical, because if you have a conversation, it would be a long conversation, but in movie terms, it's maybe 3.5 minutes, 4 minutes if it's long in a way. So, you know, you have to compress it and make it seem as if it was this very full, you know, conversation. You're not bound by time commitments when you're writing a novel. So, and you're also allowed to kind of drift back and forth in time, and insights and observations or what have you can all sort of permeate it in a way. And you don't have to stay with that economic quality that's applied to a screenplay.
Were you constantly going, I can relax here as you were writing it? Or
initially, because I started to write, and all of a sudden I was looking, I said, God, I got all this stuff in it. I'm like, 12 pages in. You know, I just got to slow down a little bit here. And so that started to occur to me quickly.
I was going to ask, and you've answered the question about Bobby Schein and his life in the television studio, some of the events. He works on a puppet show. Did you work on a puppet show?
Yes, I did that. I always worked the hand puppets and, you know, little musical numbers that we would do. And that was, for me, was the very first thing, you know, starting to think of music in terms of the puppets. And I was bringing in the rock and roll kind of music, which they hadn't been, you know, dealing with at that time. And so I learned how to do hand puppets, and I learned how to do all these other things. It was like a training program, an apprenticeship at a television station.
There's a very, very specific sequence where Bobby goes into the studio and creates a little promo for baseball. You created that promo.
Yes, for the Washington Senators.
Really?
When they had a team. I got a chance to say, all right, I'm going to do a promo for baseball for the Senators and how to do it. And rather than what was a normal way, I took Dave Brubeck's Unsquare Dance, and I took the rhythm of that, and I did the spot where guys were caught in a rundown between first and second and third, and I played it to the music and cut it to the rhythm of the piece and did that, which was like they had never done anything like that. And then for me, it was like learning as almost like a film student teaching myself, look at the effects of music and film and look how you can edit according to the music. And so I was involved in it in an obsessive way almost.
There's another sequence where he's in the midst of a conversation and the wrong reel plays of a film late at night. Again.
Yes, happened to me. I'll just explain briefly. What happened is one of the things we had to do was to roll commercial breaks into the Late Show. And the Late Show began at 11:30, used to run until about 1:30. And this is before computers and all that stuff, which is electronically done now. And so at 11:30, The Man from the Alamo, starring Glenn Ford, went on, and I'm in charge of rolling the breaks into it. And the first break, the film ran out, and then I went to the slide, and then we went to commercials, went back. But it didn't occur to me that something was really what was wrong. Why did the break come, you know, more quickly, and it didn't line up that way? So at 10 minutes to 12, all of a sudden, the Late Show says the film, it's at the end. You know, so the movie's been on for now 20 minutes. So the end. And we went to the slide, and the announcer went, and now for the beginning of The Man from the Alamo. And now what I'm amazed by, and I mentioned this, no one called in to say, why would you be showing the last reel first? And, you know, and now starting the movie at 10 to 12 with the beginning. And no one called in and complained. And we were a big television station. You know, and I was sort of fascinated, but I was nearly fired for various reasons and various mess ups that I did in the in my first year there.
When the station manager says to Bobby, "No one called in," that's rather alarming. I kept thinking, "This has to be automatic. Well, you can't make that up."
Well, I applied a lot of those things that I actually went through, and those kinds of, you know, early struggles and how you begin to make sense out of things. In trying to almost teach myself about, you know, television, film, and how music could apply to it.
Why the novel concept rather than strict autobiography?
I'm not that interested in a sense really just exploring me per se and my friends in that way. I mean, it didn't seem interesting enough as to say, look, I'll put it in a novel form, and that way I can apply things from this person, that person, and mix it up. I mean, it could probably still have called it an autobiography and get away with it, even though all the things aren't real, because God knows there's enough work out there that's been kind of tweaked around, you know. But I thought, look, it's not all, you know, fact, and there's a lot of fiction.
Why did you wait so long to deal with your own era?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I did deal with my era younger in Avalon, which I dealt with as a very little kid and the effects of, you know, television on the American family. So I did it very young, but when I did Diner, I dealt with a generation a little in front of myself. So I'm not exactly sure why I didn't at that time.
Then let me twist that around. What prompted you when writing Diner to set it some seven, eight years prior to your own generation?
Because, I mean, it's a good question, because Diner, I really wanted to deal with one issue alone, which is male-female behavior or lack of understanding about, you know, females, the problems of all of that, and how hard it is to communicate and how we struggle and fail and sometimes succeed. And so therefore I backed it up so I wouldn't be faced with the things that in fact would have taken place in 66, because, you know, the war and all of those things. So I isolated it in a sense in the late 50s. I read this review in the New York Times, which is very critical of the piece, and saying, well, it's Diner. And you go, yeah, it's Diner because it's Baltimore and the guys that pass through the diner. But the stories are very different. What I'm trying to explore here, I couldn't explore with Diner because that crowd of late 59 did not experience the same issues that the 66 crew would. Different circumstance.
In that sense, I guess, 66 bears a greater relationship to both Liberty Heights and Everlasting Peace, both of which have individualized stories set against very specific political movements going on mm-hmm. around them.
Yes. I mean, Liberty Heights dealt with the integration of the school system, and then it dealt with, you know, anti-Semitism and racism and class distinction in 1954. Everlasting Peace was dealing with... as a comedy, you know, Belfast in the early 80s, and two, you know, Whig salesmen, one's Catholic and one's Protestant. For different reasons, you do different kinds of work, and it's always nice if you can find something that makes it relevant in a way other than just sort of a nostalgic look at. I mean, because a lot of the things that apply in 66, we struggle with in one way or another, you know, today. And those issues of that, and us as people, ordinary people, we go through so many of these problems of trying to sort out our lives and make sense out of what we're going to go do. So that to me is intriguing. What's interesting to me is to take an ordinary person and find what makes this so fascinating and try to explore it somehow.
You have a character called Neil in 66 who does not fit particular stereotypes. Some of the other characters kind of fall into patterns. You have the high school star who has to deal with post-high school. But in the case of Neil, we have someone who is a soldier, but not really a soldier. He takes drugs, but he's not a druggie. Was he based on a very specific person in your life?
Yeah, two people. Two people to make, you know, Neil. I wanted to be able to show a way to deal with elements of Vietnam but not send the character to Vietnam and not do that whole thing. And so show the effects of Vietnam with a person who never left Baltimore, and to show that somebody in a military uniform, as the hippies perceived him, as he would have been some kind of like he's a soldier, the warrior, that's his mentality, and where he was as wilder than probably any of them might have been, who was not one who supported Vietnam and did not openly, was not openly against it. You didn't know where he stood in all of that. But there was this character, you know, moving among these hippies and ultimately, you know, getting involved with this, this girl. And to show the contradiction and how difficult it is to have clear, you know, lines, that it isn't so simple, that we're for and we're against. There are all of the ambiguities of it all and how to explore it comedically, dramatically.
When working on a novel or when working on a film, research plays a role. Now, I know that in Hollywood, people fudge research. They'll stick in a song that came out 6 months after the time frame. When you're working in a book, though, it's a little bit more difficult because people could go back and double check.
Mm-hmm.
How hard did you try to get that correct? For instance, Strawberry Fields Forever, when it came out, did you look that up?
I try to be as close as I can, you know, within that, as opposed to, like, you know, within the month of some of the things. And I can't remember some of the, I'd have to go through because I can't remember all the things in there. But I try to, like, follow even certain things that wouldn't matter. You know, the fact that the Flower Mart in Baltimore in 67 at that time, you know, that happened, and there was a riot, et cetera. And so the incidents within it are not the same, but that, not that somebody's going to say, well, you know, that Flower Mart and blah, blah, blah. And I almost all the songs are all within its time frame, but I may not be accurate enough by month, you know. The biggest one that I probably took in a movie was in Good Morning Vietnam, because it's a Wonderful World that Armstrong did not happen within that year. But the song was so effective effective to me that I thought I have to use it in the movie, even if I'm going to be off by more than I should, because it works too well to that. But otherwise, I try to be as close as I can.
When you were writing 66, did you have that soundtrack in your head?
Bits and pieces. You know, bits and pieces of all of that. You know, I went back and I was looking at the books and things, and then you'll get, you know, what was popular in April or May and what was coming up, what had a bullet next to it, etc. So, you know, I follow some of those things and see how I can apply it.
You're listening to an interview with Barry Levinson, whose novel is 66. Barry Levinson, after Diner came out a few years later, I would guess, I don't have particular dates, there was a pilot for a TV show called Diner. Was that set in the same era as the film?
Yes, actually it picked up after the Steve Guttenberg character, Eddie, came back from his honeymoon.
And who was in it?
It was James Spader, Michael Madsen, Paul Reiser, you know, played the same role. And I have to think. I'm trying to remember who else to it. But it was a very good cast. It was very good. It was a half hour shot on film, no laugh track, and the network said, well, it's not compatible with our other programming.
That was it.
Yes.
Today you might take it to HBO, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it was very sort of advanced. I didn't realize in a sense because they didn't like the idea of no laugh track, and it was shot on film, and it looked more real than what the sitcoms had been doing back at that, in that time. And it was, you know, it was funny, but there were moments that are not funny. No one was trying to just get to the next joke. And so all those things were just too radical for CBS at that point in time.
Barry Levinson, Bobby Shine, obviously, is going to go to Hollywood. You went to Hollywood. What brought you out to California?
I think because of what was going on in that time. In other words, I'm not sure I would have gone west if it would have been 4 or 5 years earlier. But I think, you know, everything was sort of changing so radically. The idea of finally, like, leaving and going away was not as big a deal as it might have been a few years earlier. You know, the idea of making a break was somehow more acceptable to me, I think. And I went out there not knowing what to do. Didn't know where to go, wasn't sure, didn't know anyone, and kind of left myself open to chance.
How did that first break come?
Well, I'll tell you the craziest of circumstances, and I'll try to make this as quick, as short a story. I came out to California. I was down in Hermosa Beach, and I was hanging around there, and I ran into this guy named George, and we used to hang out together and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And so at some point in time, we, you know, got this little apartment there when we, you know, and we split the rent and whatever. And one day George says to me, he says, listen, can you give me a ride into Hollywood? My card's not working, you know. I said, yeah, okay. So I drove him up there. I'm not going into Hollywood. And so we pull up and he said, look, I want to check out this acting class. I said, oh, well, I'll wait here in the car. And he said, no, come on in. I said, no, I hate that. I don't like the acting class stuff. In college, it was all fake to me. I didn't believe it. I don't like it. And he said, well, don't sit out here. I'm going to feel obligated to leave. Come on in. So I went in. It was interesting, actually. It was kind of exciting, and there were some attractive-looking girls, you know, and I'm going, oh, well, it's not so bad. And on the way back, he signs up. On the way back, I'm thinking, well, it's not so bad. It's interesting. And he said, why don't you join? We'll both go together. So I went back. I talked to the acting teacher the next day. I said, look, I'd like to join, but I don't want to be an actor. He said, well, you can't be in my class and not act. I said, yeah, but I can't just watch. He said, no, if you want to be in the acting class, you got to participate. So then George and I, for 2 months, went twice a week and took the classes. And then George got bored with the whole thing. And, you know, he enjoyed maybe just, you know, smoking some, you know, dope and in this beach chair in the living room and watching soap operas. And so he stopped going. And I would, you know, go back up there and continue to take, you know, the classes. And eventually I broke away. I said, look, George, I'm going to move up to Hollywood because I'm spending so much time there. It's too much of a drive. And so I moved up, and I never saw George again after that. And I got involved in all that. And because I was in the acting class, that led to other things. And eventually I got into writing, and that was my career because of George. I go to the movies about a year or so ago to see this movie called Blow. There's a guy named George. And as I'm watching, I'm realizing that's George. That's George that I roomed with, that I got involved in acting because of him. And he goes on to be the largest cocaine dealer in the world. That's where George went. But because of him, that is how my career began, working in that acting environment and doing improvisational stuff. And I met Craig T. Nelson, who's an actor on a television show. We started doing improvs, and that led to us doing some stand-up work, and then that led to some writing, and then blah, blah, blah.
Eventually, you began writing screenplays. What was the first one you worked on that got made into a film?
Well, I worked with Mel Brooks on two films.
Oh,
there was a
silent
group
movie.
Of us, silent movie and High Anxiety. So there were four of us, and that was a great kind of an apprenticeship in a way. And then I wanted to get out of being considered like a comedy writer, and then I wrote a film called Injustice for All, co-wrote that. And that was the first kind of moving away from just, you know, just comedy.
Your career seems to go back and forth between more commercial films and less commercial films. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and ask you about this bizarre two-track system that we've got in Hollywood today, in which some very, very bad movies make a lot of money in a week, and some very good movies don't get released at all. How do you feel about this whole system? That a movie like An Everlasting Peace or Liberty Heights can't really get released?
Well, I think you're seeing a change in the business and the direction of which it's going in, and I don't see it ever turning around, is that they're looking for that very exploitable piece of work that they can open on a weekend that does not require reviews, and they can basically go down that road. And everything else, especially movies that deal with humans and people, are too complicated to sell in an opening weekend, so they're relegated to this other place. And I don't think you're ever going to see what we used to see back in the 50s, 60s, or 70s even, where, you know, different kinds of movies coexist. I don't think it's ever going back to that. I think you've seen a departure that they're set on a course. They can open a movie and do $50 and $60 million in a weekend, and there could be another movie which is really terrific that might do $50 to $60 million in its entire run if they're lucky.
Is it absolutely imperative now for a director or writer like Barry Levinson to agree to do a film like Sphere in order to make films like Wag the Dog?
Sphere, I think, wouldn't be a good analogy, because Sphere, whether you like it or not, would have been too complicated in terms of what it was trying to do ultimately. My biggest problem in terms of Sphere for me was because I made the mistake of trying to deliver the movie when they wanted the movie rather than saying, no, I can't. And therefore, once you commit to that race to get it to be delivered, and the movie that I had was so much stranger and more peculiar than where we finally ended up in that race to get there, that's a mistake of mine in terms of trying to deal with the studio and trying to deliver a movie, you know, for a date. There was one version of it, the very early version of it, which was really interesting, and you know, they were like scared to death because it was so much more mysterious in a certain way that you didn't know. The premise of it is that there's a point in time that you have no concept of what is real or not real.
Right.
And it went to a degree where you had no idea as an audience that you didn't know what was real anymore. You need something far more simplistic in a certain way, or something that's sort of more incoherent so it doesn't matter. I mean, there are a lot of movies that, you know, that are out there and people don't quite know what's going on there, but it's so adrenaline-driven, you go, okay, that's fun. And a lot of today's audience is watching a movie not really for character and story, but watch parts of it. They watch for certain special effects sequences and certain action sequences, and that's enough to satisfy. So it's a different kind of thing. Now, will movies about people and those kinds of stories disappear? No. But they will be in a certain niche over here or on the cable or what have you. But the big track out there is going to be those expensive movies that can generate a lot of income quickly. And they've also eliminated the critic from the mix, because the critic is not in the mix anymore. And that's why actually critics are more kind to some of the bigger movies, because they know they're going to do well. So what happens is, a guy from Newsweek, you know, the writer for whatever magazine, is that person going to suddenly just criticize it because it isn't? Because then they look like, well, maybe I'm not up to date with things. So therefore, so if they can embrace some of those, then they feel like they're part of the culture. And on the other hand, some small movie that was actually trying for something that at best is never going to do a whole lot of money, they can be much more critical of.
There's so much more money to play with in the big movies than the small movies. And if Liberty Heights, if its upward level is going to be $10 million, obviously you're going to be kind of hard-pressed to do what you need to do.
Well, I mean, I think you're seeing the shift. You have to say, why are you in the business and what do you want to do? I mean, so therefore you say, okay, look, I'm not going to basically do this. I have to find a place that I can be content and satisfy myself. You know, the idea of just making a movie to be able to make, you know, a movie that's extremely popular that you may not be able to personally embrace, to me, would be a waste of time for me personally. Someone else, they could be very happy with that because they like that. I've been lucky to navigate through this that some movies of mine have been flukes and have done extremely well because it happens. You know, you get lucky every so often, as Rain Man. I mean, Rain Man, never the idea that movie in its time only cost $23 million, that did $175 million domestic, is a fluke. The idea that movie between those two characters can do that well. So I've been able to do those periodically, and sometimes you can score big.
An Everlasting Peace, Came and Went in an Hour. Mm-hmm. Fine film. What brought you to it, and were you aware that it probably wouldn't find a big audience in America?
Yeah, I thought the movie would probably never see the light of day in America, and it should have been released by a small independent, but you know, one of the studios got a hold of it and then wouldn't let it go to be done as an independent film. But I loved what it was about. I love that you can deal with Northern Ireland and Belfast in the 80s and all of the turbulent period, and have these two characters, you know, who get the franchise to sell, you know, wigs. And one's Protestant and one's Catholic, so wherever they're going door to door, it's always an odd man out. And you deal with the problems of that time, you know, with some humor and some kind of humanity. And I thought it was a worthwhile project to do.
Bandits, which is your most recent film, I mean, maybe I'm being harsher, I didn't think it worked particularly. And it struck me that there was a lot of attempt in the editing room to make it work. Am I completely wrong? Did you think it worked?
I did. I thought it worked quite well. I'm not sure what we would have done in the editing room to try to make it work. I mean, that was its design for that. So I was actually quite pleased with it as that romantic comedy and that kind of cockeyed, you know, thing of a woman who basically is involved with these two unlikely characters. Yeah, I was actually pleased with it.
Well, you can't.
We can't win them all, you know. One of the things you have to really kind of deal with in the business is that sometimes you're going to do things that people won't like as long as you jump around. If you stay in one area, you're basically going to have a fan base that'll just stay in that area, and that's all well and good. But when you jump around as much as I do, I'm always going to have some people that would say, I love the diner and the Baltimore things, but I don't care for this or I don't care for that, or vice versa. There are people that'll look at, you know, Rain Man and a couple others that never heard of any of these Baltimore films. They don't even know about them. So I'm always going to do something that someone can say, well, I don't really care for that particular movie or whatever, because they're so all over the place in terms of, you know, style, etc.
You've been listening to an interview with Barry Levinson, whose novel is 66. Envy, his next film, a comedy, comes out in the spring of 2004. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.